Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the bookshop. Fifteen years ago, my husband brought me a pressure cooker, which sat in a cupboard unused until earlier this year. Pre-pandemic, friends invited us over for a midweek dinner, saying risotto was on the menu. "Are you sure you want to go to all that trouble?" I asked my friend Doreen. "I know you're busy with work." "Oh, it's no trouble," she replied. "I'm using my pressure cooker. It's easy and it only takes 7 minutes. Wait till you try the risotto it cooks." Now I admit, I was a tiny bit suspicious. I mean, risotto in a pressure cooker in 7 minutes? When we arrived at their house, there were no sumptuous smells wafting from Doreen's kitchen. Nothing, not even the scent of sautéed garlic. But Doreen's a wonderful cook, so I kept my mind open. I scoured the kitchen benches and noticed sliced mushrooms, onions, and a jug of what I figured was veggie stock. Doreen saw my glances and pointed towards something that resembled an electric crock pot. "That's it," she said. "It's changed my life." I eyed the contraption suspiciously and said, "They make electric pressure cookers now?" She nodded and said, "Watch this." She turned a dial, poured a little olive oil into the pressure cooker, followed by onions and spices, then the rice, some wine, and the stock. She looked at me and, with the confidence of Julia Child, said, "Now I just pop the lid on, press the switch, and in 7 minutes we'll be eating delicious risotto." My husband was enamored with the machine, and when, 7 minutes later, a bell rang signaling the meal had finished cooking, Doreen flicked yet another switch, and steam poured out of a vent in the lid with the power of a locomotive at full speed. When the steam stopped gushing, Doreen took off the lid, tossed in Parmesan and parsley, then served the risotto into dishes. The smell of the food filled the kitchen, and I started to salivate. "Go ahead," Doreen said. "Try it." I plunged my fork into the risotto and let it sit on my tongue for a few minutes. I turned to her. "I told you," she said with a grin. "My pressure cooker has made my life so much easier. I'm thinking about getting another one." The next day, I pulled out my antiquity alongside my iPad and got to know how my 15-year-old stovetop pressure cooker worked. I remembered my eldest son used it once when he made chili, and he didn't blow up the kitchen. I needed to get over my fear of thinking the thing was going to explode in front of me and burn my face off. These thoughts were undoubtedly the same reason why my own mother never owned a pressure cooker. I drifted back to a time decades earlier when my mother had bought her first electric fry pan. The look of excitement on her face when she proudly served us her first meal from her new electric appliance mirrored Doreen's when she served up the risotto. I scrolled down the page of directions I had opened on my iPad, contemplated the instructions, found a recipe, and made what I hoped to be the perfect risotto. 7 minutes later, I released the pressure, sending the dog and cats at full speed into the living room. Removing the lid, I gave the contents a stir. And I must say, that evening, we ate some of the best risotto I've ever had. For the past year, my pressure cooker and I have become best friends. We get together at least twice a week to make soup, risotto, or chili. She hasn't blown up in my face or burned my fingers. She's super easy to clean, and she doesn't burn her bottom like so many of my other saucepans. I asked her to forgive me for keeping her at the back of the cooking utensil cupboard for 15 years. In return, when not in use, which is rare, she now has the primo position in my kitchen. Oh, how I adore my pressure cooker. Susan De Gaetano is co-owner of Max Back's Books in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Susan was born and raised in Cleveland Heights and South Euclid and attended Beaumont School and Miami University, where she majored in communications and political science. In 2018, she was one of the year's Cleveland Arts Prize honorees. Hi, Susan, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Max has relocated a few times throughout the years. Can you tell us a little about that and also how you became involved with the bookshop?
Well, my business partner originally opened the store when he was a student at Kent State University. And then he moved to his hometown, Chagrin Falls, Ohio. And then we opened a second store here in Cleveland Heights. And we have been on Coventry Road in Cleveland Heights since 1982. We just moved twice on the same street, just expanding our footprint each time. So we started when my business partner was in graduate school at Kent State, and we've been going ever since.
And what's the story behind the name, Max Backs Books?
My business partner's name is James McSherry, so his nickname was Mac. So trying to think of a clever name for the store when he opened it, it originally was just a paperback store. So the original name of the store is Max Backs Paperbacks. And then, as we grew and expanded and incorporated new books and hardcovers, we just changed the name to Max Backs Books on Coventry, which is our location.
In an interview for Crane's Cleveland Business, January 2018, you stated, "I think we are living in a golden age for literature, and the bonds between writers, publishers, bookstores, and readers are stronger than ever." Do you still hold true to that statement?
Well, yeah, I think there's just a lot of opportunity for writers. I think writers, maybe back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, people were, working 6 or 7 days a week, and I don't think there was as much free and leisure time. And now I think people do have some more time where they can, focus on creative activities. And so there's, I believe, more writers than ever. There's more writing programs than ever. Just in Cleveland, we have Literary Cleveland, which is a fantastic writers organization that sponsors workshops, readings, et cetera. So there's a lot of craft opportunities for writers to improve. And when you combine that with not only, the major publishers that are doing good work, but so many small press, university presses, and there's, with the consolidation with the big publishers, I think there's some opportunity for the university presses and small presses too. So I think it's a good ecosystem. I think it's a good synergy.
It seems one of the positives that has come out of this awful pandemic is that there are so many people finding their creativity. And that to me is wonderful.
Yeah, I talked to an artist that I know who's a jeweler. And so, of course, all their shows have been canceled. And, I asked her if she's doing things like Instagram sales and that kind of stuff. And she was a little sheepish. She said, "No, I'm just not good at that. I haven't been doing that. I've been painting instead." And I was like, "Well, that's cool." So, I know people are finding all kinds of ways forward in this time.
Max has supported open mic poetry readings on the second Wednesday each month since 1984. And later in the show, I'll be interviewing Larry Smith, who you mentioned was one of the first poets you featured. What keeps an event like this moving forward? And do you think there's a stronger need and want for poetry at this time?
Well, that's a really good question. Our reading series, like you said, has been ongoing since 1984, and we've basically had the same format that whole time. We put chairs in a circle. We have a couple of featured readers. After they're done reading, we take a break and then we do an open mic. And I think there's probably a lot, maybe more dramatic or sexier ways to do readings, but I've never really been able to figure it out. I think it's nice when they can be in bars or restaurants, when you can have that, level of comfort and, have a drink or something like that too, but we don't do that here. So, the focus really is on the poet and listening to the poetry. Things were so disrupted this year. We did some poetry readings, virtual poetry readings, but this is the first year we broke with our schedule of doing it, every month. So I do want to get back to that because I just crave the voices of the poets. I miss the perspective and I miss the sort of healthy centeredness that the poetry selfishly always gives me. And hopefully the people, who come to the readings and who have been reading throughout the years.
Let's talk about book clubs, and they are run by Grace Harper, who also writes the blogs on Mac's website, which I really enjoyed reading. Are the book clubs continuing via Zoom during the pandemic? And can you share with our listeners the story behind the birth of the Femme Book Club?
Well, two of our staffers got together and decided that they were informally talking about books all the time and they really wanted to formalize that process. And so they began this. And there was just a huge outpouring. Well, one of the things that we do, we have a shelf where all the book club choices are, and we discount them 20%. So, you know, that's a magnet for people when they come in the store. Emily Forsey and Rosa Ransom are our two staffers who started that. And I think they just really hit a nerve, hit a chord. And, you know, when that book club first started, we did them in the balcony. And, you know, a couple times we had to move them to the basement because there were so many people. You know, the enthusiasm for it has just been maintained. And they just read Parable of the Sower for the second time. That was the first book that they read. And then after several years, they went back to it again because of its message and timeliness. And another thing that happens at that book club is it's referential to the other books that they've read because what they've been reading, you know, is theory, a lot of theory, and it builds on itself and each other, you know, and all the books kind of talk to each other. So I think that's another good thing that might be, you know, a hallmark of that club is that it's all connected.
Do you sell more fiction or nonfiction? And is there one genre that sells better than the others?
That's a great question. We sell a lot of both fiction and nonfiction. We're in a very diverse neighborhood. There's a couple of universities nearby. So there's people that read both for pleasure and for, you know, serious reading. I'm not serious reading, but education. So we really, I think, without really looking at the numbers, I think it's pretty split. The fiction that we sell the most of here is literary fiction. It's just the way, you know, our booksellers have always tended. We do have some people who read a lot of science fiction and mysteries, the genre fiction, so are knowledgeable about that. But I think most of our customers come in looking for literary fiction, and that's what we sell the most of. Pretty typical, I think, indie bookstore profile.
So often, customers take salespeople for granted. But I found that a good salesperson possesses a rare talent and truly cares about what they're offering. The same for a good bookseller. What are your thoughts on the art of bookselling? And can you tell us about your team at Max Bax Books?
Sure. That's a great question, too. I think, well, two things. People want to browse. I'm all for that because I think there's something to be said about leaning up against the shelf, opening a book, getting involved in the first couple paragraphs and understanding if it's for you or not. And I like when people get drawn into books that way. I also love it, especially this past season when people ask for opinion, because what happened was with the pandemic, we have reduced hours. And of course we have a small store, so we had to reduce the amount of people in the store at any one time. At the same time, we really had a robust online business that was happening. And so people were, a lot of our staff time was going to processing those orders. So we really had this hunger for people to come in and ask our opinion because we weren't doing that as much. And so I remember a couple of weeks ago, this young man came in and he had decided that he and his girlfriend were going to read to each other in the new year as a different kind of activity. And he was looking for short story books. There was three of us working at the time and we descended upon him. And we all, you know, we were all pulling things off the shelf and with our favorites, you know, and we were finally like, okay, we'll stop now. Because we just were, you know, so grateful for the question that would tap into our expertise. You know, and another woman came in and she asked us for a book where the setting was just as important as any other element of the story. And so that was another question that charmed us. And you know, we love that. It's what we live for.
And I'm guessing you have a lot of local customers that come in and have been faithful for years.
We do. And people come in and look for maybe particular booksellers who they know that their recommendations have really, you know, resounded with.
And what can you tell us about the city of Cleveland Heights, Ohio, and the people who live there, in particular the area around the bookshop?
It's a street with lots of small shops and restaurants. It's human scale. It's a walking neighborhood. The community around it is, there's a lot of apartments and leafy, shady streets. It's what used to be called a streetcar suburb. And there's a lot of diversity. In fact, one of our books that just came out in December, but has been a huge hit in the community, is a local woman wrote a history called Resisting Segregation, which was how mostly women in the 60s and 70s formed organizations to integrate Cleveland Heights. And the very, very careful steps they went through as a grassroots movement to make that dream happen. And we are an integrated community. And so this book of hers did a real service because, you know, it showed us our history. And people, the acting city manager right now was involved in that. And people didn't know that about her. And so it's really, it's, so yeah, so I, of course, can't imagine living in any other kind of community. We just have a great variety of people, and our diversity is our strength.
And what kind of community outreach do you do through the bookshop?
Yeah, well, one thing that happened, I think that changed our business dramatically several years ago, when borders closed. And then we had another local chain called Joseph Beth that closed. And a lot of the libraries and reading series in town were just used to tapping in to the big chains to, you know, fulfill their book sales for their events. But at that time, those entities had to kind of look around and see who else was in the community who could be the booksellers for those events. And so we began partnering with libraries and nonprofits and taking our books on the road, and happy, willing, and grateful to go anywhere that people invited us. And so we have done a lot of work like that. You know, of course, this year disrupted it, but before that, we were probably doing probably about 150 to 200 offsite events a year. And that, you know, just was is very rewarding experience because those nonprofits, those libraries are bringing in a whole different range of authors than we would be able to attract or bring in to our store or just to fit our store profile. And so, you know, we're just exposed to, you know, a larger range of authors and voices. So it's helped our business. And it's also just been a really fun part of our business, too.
And what do you see in the future for Max Beck's Books?
Well, you know, that's another really great question. Before the shutdown, before the pandemic happened, and we had to shut down for 6 weeks, you know, like everybody else. And then we reopened in May. We reorganized our store, which our staff really worked hard at doing, and we really liked the way it looks. So we reorganized. But before that had happened, I had sort of just so happy about everything that we were doing. We had initiated a music series. We were doing, we used one wall for art in an organized, formal way with openings that we hadn't done before, in event schedule and offsite event schedule. And so I just thought that we were really, you know, doing everything that I would, you know, hope for our store and what independent bookstores do all over the country. And in our city, there's other great independents that are doing the same thing. So just had to pivot just like everybody else did and, you know, change our business model to doing more online. And so when this is all over, what I would like to happen is for us to resume our event schedule, resume the music, resume the art, and still maintain an online presence where people are coming to us for that and, you know, can continue our partnerships.
Well, just think how much stronger your online presence is. And that's all set up for the future. Now, for our listeners who may want to order a book from you online, are you signed up with IndieBound or bookshop.org?
Both. Yeah, we do. We have an indie commerce site, which is our main vehicle for online orders. But then, of course, Bookshop has been, you know, a great partner. And they've done, in just a short period of time, they've done such a great thing. I love their website. I love, you know, what they're doing and how it works. And so we also sell books with Bookshop, too.
And is there one book you'd like to see more people read?
The book that I would love more people to read, I think, is The Radiance of Tomorrow by Ishmael Bea, who wrote the memoir Long Way Gone, which was a bestseller and most people know him for. But I don't think he's known for his subsequent two novels. And I read, you know, Radiance of Tomorrow, and I just like to evangelize for that book.
Thank you so much, Susan, for being on the show. And if anyone's trying to find you online, the address is maxbacks.com. And I'll put all the information in the show notes. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
If you're enjoying the Bookshop Podcast, please consider becoming a patron. For more information, go to www.patreon.com/thebookshoppodcast. Or you can go to my website, mandyjacksonbeverly.com, click on the Bookshop Podcast, and you'll find more information about me and the podcast there. From bookshop to author. Larry Smith is a native Midwesterner born and raised in a working-class family in the industrial Ohio River Valley. In 1965, he graduated from Muskingum College in Ohio and at 21 married a hometown girl, Ann Zabin. He worked in the steel mills that summer and they soon moved to Euclid, Ohio, where he taught high school and Ann began working as a nurse. Larry earned an MA and a PhD at Kent State University. In 1970, the family moved to Huron, Ohio, where he began teaching at Firelands College of Bowling Green State University. In 1980, the family moved to Sicily, where Larry was a Fulbright lecturer in American literature. Larry is the author of 8 books of poetry, a book of memoirs, 5 books of fiction, 2 literary biographies of authors Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Kenneth Patchen, and 2 books of translation from the Chinese co-translator Ma Hui Huang. His photo history of his hometown Mingo Junction appeared recently in the Images of America series. 2 of his film scripts on authors James Wright and Kenneth Patchen have been made into films with Tom Kober and shown on PBS. From 1970 to 2010, he was professor of English and humanities at Fireland College, where he taught writing and literature, and served as director at the Firelands Writing Center, a cooperative of writers. Larry is the director of the literary publisher Bottom Dog Press, Inc., and has edited over 60 books and carried into publication some 170 titles of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. In addition, Larry is a consultant for Wayne State University Press and has reviewed Free American Book Review, Parabola, Small Press Review, Choice, the San Francisco Review of Books, the Columbus Dispatch, Ohio Anna Quarterly, Heartlands, and the New York Journal of Books. Larry's poetry has also been featured on American Public Media's Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor. I asked Larry what it is about writing that he enjoys the most.
Well, I start each day kind of meditation that leads into often the act of writing. And I feel like I've done something good at the beginning of the day if I can write something. And I will come back to it later and revise and look at it and add to it. But it's just satisfying. It's confirming who I am. A lot of people struggle with, am I a writer? Am I not a writer? They need some kind of award before they feel they're a writer. And I just tell them, if you're writing, you're a writer. And enjoy that. You know, where it goes is to something else, you know. But the fact that the writing is always the most pleasure. And if you've done book signings and readings in shopping malls and things, you realize that's not where the enjoyment is. It's in the act of writing, first of all.
I think of writing as a series of relationships. Firstly, that relationship with yourself. But I remember when my husband and I and sons were in Japan, we were at this beautiful tea ceremony. And I had a conversation with one of the people who had arranged the tea ceremony for us and commented on the beauty of the teacups we had been using. They were very raw looking, which is the kind of ceramics I love. He said, well, they were centuries old. I was slightly taken aback because the realization of what I had been drinking from dawned on me. And he reminded me that that was part of the process. They are made to be used. When we arrived back in LA, I went to a ceramics class because I was studying ceramics at the time. And the teacher opened the kiln with all of our latest work in it. And I commented on how beautiful everything looked. And she turned to me and she said, you know, the ceramics isn't finished until you have either had a drink out of or eaten food out of the dish. And I think about that when I think about the act of writing, because as much as it's a relationship with self, it's also a relationship of people reading what you've written.
You know, you talk about the Japanese tea ceremony. There's a great essay by Terry Tempest Williams, where she's talking about 2017, 2018, what it's like to live through the last 4 years. And interspersed with that is a tea ceremony she's taking part in italics. And so you get that very focused and peaceful ritual of the tea ceremony. Then she'll talk about the world. And it sort of feels how it feels today. You know, we go back and forth between tensions and finding some peace. The tea ceremony, any ritual like that that's done with intention can be beautiful.
You have written two literary biographies of authors Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Kenneth Patchen. Both were considered beat poets. What drew you to their stories?
They're different writers, even though they're linked. And Patchen later denied being a beat poet because, of course, he'd been around for 20 years before the Beats. But Patchen writes about working people in Ohio, working class families. And I read those poems and felt, you can write about this. You can tell your family story. You can talk about the local and make it mythic in a way. So that was the draw to Patchen. And he is so diverse, and he said every book he wrote is a different book. And he is magical in that way. And Ferlinghetti, I was drawn to him as a writer and as a publisher of City Lights Books. And that was an inspiration for starting our own Bottom Dog Press books. They tell the truth. Neither one of them were in my college textbooks. We didn't study Ferlinghetti. We didn't study Kenneth Patchen. And so when I did my dissertation on Patchen and wrote the first book, I was immediately the expert on Kenneth Patchen because everybody else was afraid to, because he was a rebel. And so is Ferlinghetti, a rebel. So I have always been drawn to that, something that goes outside and looks at it from the edge and speaks to it.
Can you tell us about Patchen's art?
Oh, yeah. In the last phase of his life, when he is bedridden, he is doing the picture poems, which are paintings with his words. Again, you'd like the calligraphy that he works into those images. And they would be published in portfolios often. And then New Directions, who was the chief publisher, would do like black and white reproductions of them, but was not satisfying as the brilliant color that he worked with, and very imaginative, creating creatures but really engaged messages as well.
Patchen's work to me brings the word earthy to mind. I'm wondering if that comes from the work he did outside of writing or stems from the region where he was born.
Well, I have to tell you, he did not work long. He saw himself as an artist, poet, and that was his chief work. And so at one point, he and his wife are working for New Directions, actually doing shipping and handling and who knows what else. And it was a great job. And he was living in Norfolk, Connecticut, where James Laughlin lived. And then he just walked away from that job and went back into Greenwich Village. And I think he was hurt. He worked in the steel mills a couple summers, just as I did a couple summers. And he said, that's not what I want to do the rest of my life. But he knew that his father sacrificed much for the family by working hard jobs in the steel mills. So he speaks for those people, but he didn't want to become that. He didn't want to become a slave to hard labor.
Now, you are the director of Bottom Dog Press. It's a nonprofit, independent literary publisher. How does that work?
Yeah, well, I see it, again, it's writing that's underserved. The Working Lives series is about working class lives. And so it's meant for, I would call them my people, you know. And I think sometimes when we would publish those books, the very people we were writing for didn't understand that they should be written about, that their lives were important, that they did matter. So it's been a long struggle getting the audience. In one case, we had a book, a working class studies book, and the students were taking the book home. And then the mother was ordering the book. I mean, she found that book spoke to her and spoke to her life. So Bottom Dog Press in Ohio, we survived at first on grants from the Ohio Arts Council. And so we would do two or three books a year. Again, it was for a deserving audience. And so I think nonprofits are supposed to do what the corporations are not doing and keep literature alive in that way. And so we do literature. It has to be fine writing that we publish. And we publish memoirs, fiction about Appalachia, fiction about working people, and poetry. We have a strong poetry collection. Now, who else is going to publish poetry but fellow writers? You know, I often, when I negotiate with the writer for a book, I say, don't forget, I'm a writer too. And I'm not going to use you, and I'm not going to make decisions without you. So it's a kind of co-op in the relationship. But, you know, we're paying all the bills and we're doing all the work. It's a devotion to art and writing.
You're keeping the writing honest.
Yeah, you're right.
You earned an MA and PhD degrees at Kent State University. This was at a time when riots and shooting of students occurred on the campus. What effect did this have on you and your fellow students?
Well, I was both a teaching fellow at that time. And so I was a student in the graduate program, and also I had students that I was teaching. And my wife was working as a nurse in nearby Ravenna. And so the day of the shootings, she was at work, and I was at home with our one-year-old daughter, Alara. And when I could talk to her on the phone, she told us, they're bringing the bodies in, and it's the students. And the news at that time was saying that the National Guard had been shot and they were the ones wounded and taken in. And it was all a lie. And she was there and she was watching it happen. My neighbor came over, I remember, and said, Larry, they're shooting our students. They're shooting our students. And that is how it felt. And so both Ann and I became more active as peace and justice advocates. And began a group up here in this area called Voices for Peace and Justice. And so that's a part of Bottom Dog Press, too. I just got an order for our book we did called Come Together, Imagine Peace. That was done about 5 years ago. And it was writers from around the nation and really some wonderful writers. And they were all about imagining peace, not anti-war, but imagining a peace. If we don't imagine it, it's going to go away.
And I'll make sure to put the link to Imagine Peace in the show notes. Now, the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program sends American scholars and professionals abroad to lecture or conduct research for up to a year. In 1980, you were a Fulbright lecturer in American literature in Sicily. How did you find the Italian approach to education, in particular literature? Was it different to what you were used to? And did you enjoy your time living there?
We were in Catania, at the University of Catania, and I remember looking for the university, and it was spread all over the town, in this building. And for one thing, they called me professor over there, where that doesn't happen back here. There was this sort of like recognition. I remember starting class on time. You couldn't do that in Italy. There's always this 10-minute grace period where people come in. I would get there on time and nobody would be in there, and they would drift in. These were graduate students taking the course in English. And I had a co-teacher in Maria Victoria D'Amico. So she would help me. And I was not teaching in Italian, was learning Italian, but I was teaching in English. The course was American Romanticism and the Beat Movement. So I'm teaching Thoreau and Emerson, these kind of idealists, and most Sicilians are not romanticists. They're kind of pessimists. Their philosophy got to me more than my philosophy got to them. But I took my whole family, Ann and I, three kids, 4 years old, 8 years old, and 12 years old. And the Fulbright people kept saying, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this? Are you going to educate them in American schools over there? And we did not. We took them to the Italian schools. And that was an experience that changed their lives forever. You know, you learn about culture, you learn about people other than yourselves. Ann and I were talking recently about what a life-changing experience that was for those kids. And one man we met said, "You're so lucky your kids get the experience being a minority." And I don't know if my kids felt that all the time, but it was. And so were we. But the teaching was a little different. It was mostly lecture. My colleague was teaching Whitman, and I was Walt Whitman. Whenever they wanted someone to read, I was the American. You read the Whitman part. And I loved it. I loved being Walt Whitman. But it was a challenge, and it was something that helped our whole family to grow in many ways.
Yeah, living in another country is a great way to expand your awareness.
Yeah.
In our emails back and forth, you wrote, "More than style, I see intention as behind writing and publishing as key." Can you expand on this, please?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have to do this, and it's not money-making. I mean, it's pay the bills. It's a nonprofit. And we do pay the bills. We pay writers, we pay artists and photographers. And I'm always so happy to do that when it comes time to pay royalties for the books sold. And we're doing books that deserve to be published. You know, so that's the intention. I get books sent from Saudi Arabia, from New York City. And I said, we're Midwest. You understand that? And this is our region. We're going to feed to that first, because it's ignored often by the East and West Coast presses, and certainly by the big corporate presses. So the intention is to serve, and I love literature. You know, I was so lucky to be able to make a living reading books I love and teaching books I love. So the intention is clear. I did study Buddhism. And I know about focusing and letting that become a part of the message. You know, you don't have to preach it. It's there. It's there. The intention is in the work.
And that's a good segue into my next question. Would you like to share a poem of yours with our audience, please, Larry?
I'll tell you, I have one that fits along with that. It's called "Why I Read Books." And it's a true story. I am home from college, resting on our back porch in a webbed lawn chair, when my dad comes through on his way to the garage. I look up from my book, Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, and he stops, takes a breath, and then asks it, "Son, do you ever think of doing something instead of just reading a book?" I am struck, hard swallow, and shrug a simple smile. Dad is a railroader, always finding work. And I, his pathetic son right now, waiting to find a summer job. He disappears down the steps, but returns 5 minutes later for something he's forgotten. Ready now, I enter the house. "Wait, Dad, can I speak?" He turns from the sink. "Yeah, what's up, boy?" I am 20, yet glad to be his boy. "Dad, I want to answer you." He nods. And facing each other, I try. "I don't know if I can say it right, Dad, but some of these books, well, they have honestly saved me and kept me going." We stand in that great quiet, two men sharing a felt connection, like a prayer offered and accepted. We are not the hugging Smiths, but yet we both feel held. So that's why I write and why I read, because it does matter and because it keeps us sane in so many ways.
And honest in so many ways.
Yes.
And which book is that from?
That's in the Mingo book.
Can you talk about this book a little bit, please, Larry? It looks wonderful.
Okay, so I had read a book by Susan Petrone called The Heebie-Jeebie Girl. It's a novel, The Heebie-Jeebie Girl, set in Youngstown, Ohio. And the remarkable thing she did in that novel was let Youngstown speak. You have characters and narrators, but one of the narrators is Youngstown. And so it just hit me that I have been writing about my hometown forever, you know, and I never let my hometown speak. So why not create poems in which the town speaks? So I have a sense of my hometown because I don't live there anymore, but we go back there every month and I feel connected to it. And I feel close watching it change, grow and decline and grow, but not judging it. So the first two thirds of the book is of poems of Mingo Junction. To me, it's one town of many towns. It's one of those steel mill towns in the United States that's suffering from financial decline. The steel mills are closed. The stores are, some cases, fallen in and, you know, blanked out. So I wanted to tell that story in a positive way because I see a positive side to the hometown. And the second part are more memory poems I had written throughout my career about the hometown. Now, my wife's cousin is a writer too. And when he read my book, Mingo Town, his response was, wow, this is not the Mingo Town I grew up in. This is your Mingo Town. My Mingo Town is different. His Mingo Town is pretty harsh. And he doesn't go back anymore. He thinks of it as a dirty mill town that he had to leave. And I think of it as the great people that are still living there. And I know those people and I know how they take care of that town with or without money. And they take care of each other. They're always watching over each other. And so I write more about those values that are lasting. And there are many people on their webpage that feel sorry for Mingo. But people in Mingo don't want you to feel sorry for them. They don't want you to pity them. They see it as a life that they've accepted. It is changing, and they're going to live it out, and they're going to survive. So it's a town of survival. It's changed every decade. It seems to be different in that town.
And why do you think some people leave and some people stay?
When I go back for like a class reunion, there will be some of my classmates still living in that town. And I think they just loved it, and they were so connected to family. If the family is still there, then you're part of that town. And I get such a positive response in the Facebook page for Mingo that I feel like there are so many people who have that same deep connection. So those who leave, I think, have not been back. They don't stay connected to family. You know, the buildings are falling down in some cases. Churches, the last time I was there, two of the famous churches were being taken down, torn apart. I lived on Church Hill. You know, there were so many churches in that small town. But I also did a book for the Arcadia books where they take a town and you take the photos from that town. It's mostly photos. And my friend from the hometown, Guy, who still lived there, he and I did the book. And so we started researching Mingo Junction and needed photos. And the library in Steubenville did not have those photos. The people in Mingo kept those photos. And they came down to Guy's shop and we would scan the photos and they would share their notebooks and they would tell the stories of the town. So, I mean, to me, that was a beautiful experience. That's where you get close. You know the stories, you know the people. So when we did that book, we put everybody's name in. If you put a picture in, you had to have the name of that person there, because in Mingo Junction, you have to name the person. You connect them for the person who's looking at it. So it was, in a way, honoring that town.
It's a wonderful concept for a book, Larry, and I wish you all the best with it.
You know, how do you feel about poetry right now? I seem to think the virus didn't shut down poetry. I see it all over the internet, you know, these virtual readings that are going on. And I'm happy to see that it's needed and it's shared and it's really flourishing in some ways.
I agree. And if you go to a platform like Instagram and search the word poet, one of the first ones that comes up is Poets of Instagram. That has 3 million followers. I believe the arts in all forms has power to bring forth great change, or at least to manifest it in a passive way.
Yeah.
I think when it gets down to it, we're humans and we love stories.
I understand. When we go back to Mingo Junction, like back for a funeral, sometimes a wedding, more often funerals, the grandkids are there. And I have 8 grandkids. And there's a point where they want to get in the car and drive through Mingo. And I'm the driver and I'm the guide and I'm the historian. And they want to go past the old houses. So this is where Grandma Peroni lived. This is where Grandma Zabin lived. And they want to go past and get the narration. Even though I think every time they go, I do this. It's like a tradition to do that. And I'm so pleased that they care, about Mingo Junction. They actually love going there. Where other people, I again, think it's a dead town and it's worn out. It's not. You know, I used to teach a class in Ohio Writers. And so we would go to their hometowns. At the end, it was a summer course. And so on Friday, we'd load up in a van and a caravan. And we would go to Lorain, Ohio, where Toni Morrison lived. We'd go to Columbus. We'd go to Mingo Junction, actually, in Martins Ferry, where James Wright, the poet, lived, just 20 minutes away from where I live. Like an initial inspiration for me was James Wright. And I remember driving through Mingo Junction, and I said, that's the house I used to live in. And they blew the horn. They wanted to stop and go in. But I didn't know anybody was living there anymore. And I said, no, I don't want to go in. And my one student said, I think you have issues, Mr. Smith. I think you've got issues. And I thought, well, maybe you're right. I don't want to see it changed again because it lives in my memory.
For anybody listening who'd like to get hold of Larry or learn more about Bottom Dog Press, you can just Google Bottom Dog Press. But Larry, would you like to tell us a little bit about your submission guidelines, please?
Yeah, we have guidelines on there. And I also added recently a helpful guide on writing a query. What I ask people to do is to first begin with email, send me 2 paragraphs, one about the book you have and one about yourself and yourself as a writer. And then we'll go from there. But there are guidelines on how to submit. I get about 5 a week. Like you say, there's a lot of creativity going on. People are turning to writing books. The next book we're going to publish is by a doctor, a hematologist, you know, and it's about small town in Tennessee. And he's also an author, but this is his first book of fiction. And so it comes in that way, and it should work with one of our series, the Midwest, not just Ohio, Midwest. So Michigan, Pennsylvania, Indiana, West Virginia, and we do an Appalachian series of particularly writers from Appalachia. And you don't have to live there now, but you have to have that deep connection to Appalachia. So there are, if you go to that one link, you'll link onto all these other links.
Larry, thank you so much for being on the show and talking about you, your writing, and Bottom Dog Press.
Thank you. But I appreciate what you're doing.
And thank you for listening. Remember, buy local, read global, support your local indie bookshop. I'll see you around the corner. For updates about the show, make sure to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Mandy Jackson Beverly.